From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we are watching breaking news out of Washington. Former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen is being sentenced as we speak. We'll have more later in the program.
Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Theresa May could lose her job today if she loses a no-confidence vote over her Brexit plan. May faced her critics in the House of Commons earlier today, including Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn.
She's already been found to be in contempt of Parliament. Will she now put this deal before Parliament and halt this escalating crisis, which is so damaging to the lives of so many people in this country?
Joining us now is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Rob, what are you expecting today with this no-confidence vote?
Well, I guess the first thing to say, Jeremy, is that anyone who had been having any doubts as to whether Britain was experiencing a profound political crisis has probably had those doubts dispelled, because I think what we're seeing is further evidence what might be called the sort of quasi-revolution in British politics sparked by the referendum vote in 2016. So the latest episode is the challenge to the leadership of the Prime Minister, Theresa May. The latest sort of view is that she will probably survive. But here's the thing, she may win and lose at the same time. What do I mean by that? That she'll survive the vote of confidence, but that so many of her own MPs will have voted against her that she will seem to be an even further weakened leader than she is already.
How could she survive the vote of confidence if there are so many people in her party that signed on to the idea of having a no-confidence vote?
The answer to that is that it may well be because quite a number of Conservative MPs, maybe a majority, she will hope, Jeremy, will buy into her argument that this is just a crazy time to have to change leader when you're in the middle of a crisis over Brexit. And again, without getting into the weeds too much of British politics and the politics of the Conservative Party, an awful lot of Conservative MPs are mad as hell at the right wing of the party that believes in this sort of hardest of hard Brexits, a really kind of abrupt break between Britain and the European Union. So even though the vast majority of Conservative MPs by this point don't actually think that Theresa May is exactly Winston Churchill or anything, that they're not sure that they want to dump her, at least not yet.
Now, earlier today, the Prime Minister faced questions, as she does each week, and one of the big questioners was the Labour Party leader, Jeremy Corbyn. And actually, ran on U.S. television live, which was pretty amazing. That doesn't usually happen. But, you know, a lot of people, look at Jeremy Corbyn as somebody who could become the prime minister, but he doesn't want to get rid of Brexit. He can't really tell what his position is on it.
Well, I don't think the Simpsons' grip on American TV is under threat, I don't think, from a regular set too between Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May. Do you know what I would say about this? And the Labour leadership wouldn't thank me for this. I do think if the opposition Labour Party were led by anyone who was a bit more, how can one put it, a bit sort of quicker-witted, a bit more humorous, a bit more forensic than Jeremy Corbyn, I suspect Theresa May would be out of a job and that the Conservatives would be out of power and that maybe indeed even Brexit would be stopped, because I think there is a sort of feeling in British politics that the most extraordinary thing has happened, that you have at the very time at which Britain is trying to do something more complicated than it's ever done in peacetime to extricate itself from the European Union, that the main opposition party has almost sort of gone missing, that it's not providing that kind of forensic challenge. And some people say that's Jeremy Corbyn personally, and some would say that it's partly that he himself is a profound Eurosceptic and may well, whatever he says or doesn't say, actually think that it's a good thing that Britain is leaving the European Union, even though many of Labour's supporters and many of its MPs profoundly disagree with him. So in some senses, Theresa May, if you like, all of the opposition she gets is from within her own party.
One of the questions that came up in our news meeting here this morning, Rob, was what do the Europeans think of all of this that's going on? It does seem like they're kind of standing back and saying, OK, let's see what happens in Britain.
Well, I'm sorry I gave you such a long answer to the last question. The answer to this one is much easier. They just think Britain has gone bonkers. I mean, they really do. I mean, they think that it was a profound mistake when Britain voted to leave the European Union. And they just think that if it was possible to make even more of a hash of it than Britain is at the moment, they can't quite imagine that.
Okay, final question. What does all this mean for Brexit?
it means that it's everything is just totally on hold until this issue has been sorted out. If she wins, in many ways, it doesn't change all the uncertainty that she faced before. In other words, we are stuck with this fundamental problem, which is what means Britain is in a crisis, and that is, as we have discussed before, Jeremy, there is no political consensus in Britain as to what on earth to do about the result of the 2016 referendum. It's as simple but as seismic as that.
That's the BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson on a busy day in London. Another one. Rob, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, now let's turn to Los Angeles, where after years of debate, the city will soon be cracking down on Airbnb rentals throughout the city, including tourist hotspots like the beachfront town of Venice. The LA City Council yesterday approved new rules that will go into effect in July. So what do they mean for Airbnb hosts, for renters, for other cities? Matt Tinoco covers housing for KPCC in Los Angeles. It's that big a topic, Mac. And tick through some of the major changes they might see.
Right. So under the rules passed yesterday, hosts are basically allowed to home share for 120 days in a year. Home sharing refers basically to people who to lease out, say, a spare room in their house or their apartment, and it's their primary residence. It's the housing unit where they live in, and they want to host somebody else in there.
Right.
Which really, until now, there haven't been any rules governing any short-term rentals. So now, at least that part of it, hosts who want to lease out a room in their primary residence are allowed to do that for 120 days.
Well, and why only 120 days? If these are homes where people are living, I know there's also concern that people may be buying up rental properties to rent them as Airbnbs are not even there. There are restrictions on that we'll hear about. But why can't somebody have an Airbnb person in their home for more than 120 days?
Honestly, I can't give you a good reason. This process has been really going on for the past 3.5, almost 4 years now. And it's been really just a protracted back and forth between the companies themselves, the hosts, tenants activists, neighborhood activists. And actually, one of the phrases used by one of the city council members, Mike Bonin, yesterday was that nobody is actually super happy with this ordinance. It doesn't fully satisfy anyone. Any individual.
Yeah.
And I think we'll see how this plays out looking forward. But
so you talk about the amount of time. And as we said, they'll only be able to rent out primary residences. Is that to stop people from buying up, you know, rentals and other things to rent as Airbnbs?
Yes. Short answer. Yeah. Because that is really, I don't think anybody, the neighborhood activists, the tenant activists who are worried about these platforms, I don't think anybody really seems to mind, you know, a homeowner leasing out a spare bedroom. The concern is the large commercial operator who buys up an apartment building is like, well, we can make more money by leasing to tourists than long-term residents. Or an existing property manager who tries to kick out all the people who are living in a building to lease to sort of a revolving door of tourists, which that does happen. There have been a lot of court cases and that does happen in sort of the touristy neighborhoods like Venice, Hollywood, et cetera.
Right. Well, and also you won't be able to do this Airbnb rentals in rent-controlled units. That makes a lot of sense. There is a housing crisis in California, so you need those units perhaps for residents. But we also include that – we also see that the restrictions include non-residential buildings and temporary structures. Now, people know places like Venice, you know, beach volleyball, bodybuilders – have people been renting out tents for Airbnb?
I actually do remember anecdotally a tent being rented out on Airbnb, but I think this is more targeted at you know, the backyard. Maybe you put a tough shed in the backyard, put a little bed in it, or you're leasing out your garage, and these are structures that aren't necessarily quote unquote fit for human habitation. And I mean, it's beyond, that's a bigger issue in Los Angeles than just short term rental platforms. But that's something that the city is paying very close attention to, just making sure that people are living not in substandard housing conditions. And that extends to rentals, I guess.
Yeah. Well, as you said, a big battle here. Airbnb spent millions lobbying. So did the hotel industry. They seem to have come out on top. But what about hosts? A lot of people are saying a host can collect the equivalent of a month's rent in about 10 days on the Airbnb market. And some of them are saying, hey, we're not rich or anything. We're going to be losing a major source of income.
It's hard because there's lots of different types of hosts, right? Like the person leasing out an extra bedroom or even like a back house for a tourist it's different than the commercial operator who can. Like that number that you just said is more for the apartment. So you can earn the amount of money that a tenant would pay in rent over a month in 10 days for short-term rentals, which there's a very, very clear financial incentive to switch over a property to short-term rentals as opposed to, say, a year-long lease property. But it's just hard because also the companies won't really publicize information. Like, I've asked so many times to say, hey, can you give me the breakdown of who's a commercial operator, who has multiple listings versus who is leasing in just, say, a spare bedroom? And that information isn't made available to the public, which makes it very, very hard to distinguish between, you know, hosts who are just a regular person versus a corporate operator who is really trying to extract the most amount of money from a piece of property.
Well, and we have a few seconds, but I just want to comment that it also makes it hard to regulate this. I mean, you can have a restrictions, but how do you know who's doing what? Matt Tinoco, housing reporter for KPCC, we'd love to have you come back to talk about that. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Trump administration has cut U.S. aid to the Palestinians with one big exception, the Palestinian security forces in the West Bank. Even as fighting has broken out between Israel and militants in the Gaza Strip, these forces have helped keep the West Bank largely calm. NPR's Daniel Estrin visited a training base in the West Bank to find out more about them.
So now all these special forces guys in masks just ran out of their cars with guns pointed, and they're handcuffing and arresting the suspect, throwing him into an unmarked car.
This is a drill by an elite unit of the Palestinian security forces. Their job is to secure their own areas and make sure Palestinians don't attack Israelis. They were established during peace talks in the 90s, and the U.S. sponsors them. The U.S. built this training base in the desert hills of Jericho. And a 3-star U.S. general is stationed in Jerusalem to support the forces. Neri Zilber is an adjunct fellow with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
Security is the essential component for any diplomatic progress. That's why the investment was made to professionalize the security forces over the past decade. And the results speak for themselves.
Despite some recent attacks, violence in the West Bank has been lower overall in recent years. Palestinian officials and the Israeli military share intelligence and coordinate their movements. The U.S. sees this as crucial to Israeli security. But in October, Congress passed a law that would cut funding to these forces unless the Palestinian Authority compensates American victims of terror attacks. The administration could seek to still keep the money flowing. But the forces face a lot of criticism among their own people. For one, they've committed abuses, arresting government critics, some of whom say they've been tortured. And they're criticized for taking U.S. money in the first place, says analyst Zilber.
They're the only ones still getting U.S. money from a Trump administration that's not viewed very favorably in Palestine. It only reinforces domestically for the Palestinian security forces this image, this slur that they're only collaborators.
In other words, some Palestinians think the forces do Israel and America's bidding. Forces spokesman Hafez Arifai defends their job.
We are preparing for the establishment of the Palestinian state. We're preparing elite groups, security people, in order to have everything ready by the time the Palestinian state is formed.
That argument is getting harder to make to many average Palestinians who question whether they'll ever get their own country. Israel's occupation of the West Bank has lasted 51 years and counting. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu argues Israel can never totally leave the land because it can't depend on the Palestinian security forces. He spoke to NPR recently.
The bulk of the security operations is done by us. We have, say, information about a terrorist cell in one of the Palestinian towns. We would call up typically the Palestinian security authorities and say, why don't you take care of it? Very often the answer that comes back is, no, you take care of it. It's not comfortable for the Palestinians to deal with their own people.
Retired Israeli Brigadier General Shlomo Brom says, of course the Palestinians prefer Israel carry out some of these operations so they don't look like an Israeli contractor. As a researcher at the Israeli Institute for National Security Studies, he meets with Israeli and Palestinian security officials, and he's convinced the Palestinian forces would be capable of handling security in a future state.
So in principle, they can do it. Now it's very difficult to convince the Israelis to trust that they will have the motivation to do it.
At the base in Jericho, Palestinian servicemen stand in formation and get certificates for completing a training course. 31-year-old service member Mahmoud Hawamde says he is proud to serve.
I want to defend my people to create a united front until our country is liberated.
Palestinians say if their forces stop believing that independence is on the horizon, they won't be motivated to continue doing their job of helping Israel police the West Bank. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Jericho.
Last month, scientists in the General Conference of Weights and Measures voted unanimously to redefine the kilogram. And as of May 20th, 2019, a physical piece of metal will no longer be used to define the weight of a kilogram. Joining us now is Patrick Abbott, who's a physicist at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Patrick, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's good to be here.
So before we talk about the new standard for the kilogram, tell us about the old way of measuring. They used an actual cylinder of metal.
Yes, that's right. Since the year 1889, the world's standard for mass has been defined by what is known as the International Prototype Kilogram, which is a cylinder of metal, as you say, platinum-iridium alloy, 90% platinum, 10% iridium, that resides at the International Bureau of Weights and Measures in Sèvres, which is a little area just outside of Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And it has served as the world's mass standard for over 100 years now, and it's about to be replaced.
Well, and it stays constant at the same weight all the time? It never changes even a little tiny bit?
So it's very interesting. We know from differential measurements, that is comparisons against other masses, that it does change by a little bit on the order of micrograms, but by international agreement, the mass of the International Prototype Kilogram is always defined to be exactly 1 kilogram, no matter what.
Why do you need a physical object to tie the weight of a kilogram to?
Well, it's been the most practical and really easy way to realize a unit of mass. Before the International Prototype Kilogram came into being, there was simply a standard that was based on volume of water. It was 1,000 milliliters of water, and that was defined to be 1 kilogram. Mm. Overall, it's a very easy way to realize a unit with an artifact. But as you pointed out earlier, its stability with time is somewhat suspect, and there are all sorts of problems that could possibly change the artifact.
Okay, so that brings us to today, and the scientists have decided they don't need that physical object. What are they doing now? What are they going to use to determine what a kilogram is?
Well, it turns out that there is an experiment that can relate mass to a constant of nature, which is the Planck constant, and it's a constant that comes out of the branch of physics known as quantum mechanics. This constant can be related to mass through an experiment that measures virtual power.
But you can't actually hold it in your hand. There's nothing physically there, right?
The best way to kind of look at it is when you get on your bathroom scale in the morning, you have some confidence that it's right, mm-hmm. correct? Because there's a spring in there, and that spring changes its length with the application of the force that mm-hmm. you put on it when you stand on there. Now, there's some sort of a proportionality constant that you multiply by the change in the spring, and that gives me a fair representation of the mass. It's the same idea with the experiments that are being used, and the Kibble balance is the official name of the experiment that NIST does. So what happens is you actually put in an artifact, a kilogram artifact, whose mass you do not know. I mean, you know it's 1 kilogram nominally, but you don't know whether it's plus a little bit or minus a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You put it on this little pan, and it's sort of like a scale, and it wants to go down. Well, what the experiment does is it creates an electromagnetic force that tries to offset the force of gravity so that it just stays in one position. And by measuring the power that it takes to do that and multiplying by the Planck constant, we can get the mass of the artifact. So it's kind of like you stand on the scale, the amount of power that it takes to keep the the mass in one place is what changes, and then we multiply that by the Planck constant, and then you get mass.
But you're basically taking a physical object and replacing it with a math problem.
Exactly. It becomes an experiment. That's right. The idea is to bring mass into the same realm as all of the other quantities. For instance, length. The way that we define length is not through a stick, a yardstick, or a meter bar anymore. The way it's done now is through the speed of light. We know very precisely, in fact, it's defined with no uncertainty, we know the speed of light, and we know how to measure time very, very accurately. Distance is velocity times time. So if I take the speed of light and I multiply that by a certain amount of time, I can get exactly 1 meter. And that's the definition of length. So in a sense, it does the same thing. It takes a physical object and turns it into a math problem. I think that's a good way of putting it. And all of the units are going to be defined that way. No more artifacts at all. The kilogram was the last one.
So what does this mean to you? You're in a country, one of the only countries on Earth, that doesn't use the metric system officially.
Well, officially we don't, but practically we do. The entire metric system came about as an international agreement back in 1875 at the convention of the Treaty of the Meter, where the world agreed that units had to be standardized for mostly purposes of trade. The United States was one of the signatories of that treaty, and as a result, we were given 2 prototype kilograms that are copies of the international prototype kilogram, and then we convert into the traditional units that we use in the United States.
That is Patrick Abbott, who's a physicist at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, part of the Commerce Department here in the United States. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
And you can see a photo of the old measure of a kilogram. It's in a glass case, kind of looks like something you'd put a cake in, at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
And today, a judge sentenced President Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, to 36 months in prison. Cohen pled guilty to dodging taxes, lying to Congress, and campaign finance violations in paying off women who claimed to have had affairs with then-candidate Donald Trump in 2016. Today, at a sentencing, Cohen told the judge he took full responsibility for his actions, but said he felt like he had to cover up Trump's dirty deeds. NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing is here. Phil, Cohen's lawyers argued he shouldn't be locked up at all. The New York prosecutor recommended 3.5 years. The judge sentenced him to 3. Michael Avenatti, the lawyer for Stormy Daniels, one of the women in the case of being paid off, quickly jumped up to a microphone outside the courtroom and said, Michael Cohen is no hero for working with the Russia investigation because he belittled and called his clients liars. Who wins here?
That is a great question. I don't know who does win the situation, except to say that from Cohen's perspective, it could have been a lot worse, even though, as you suggested in your comments a moment ago, it could have been a lot better. He was looking at potentially a lot more time here, and this 3-year sentence is not going to be a picnic. He's also, we understand, going to have to pay fines and restitution as well and be on supervised release after he gets out of prison, but he could have gotten more time. So I'm not sure how you want to fill out the score sheet, except to say that things could have gone a lot worse for Cohen specifically today.
Well, what about the special prosecutor Mueller's investigation? That seems to come out on the winning side because obviously they got information and informed, someone who worked with them is still serving time.
That's right. And the special counsel's office released some court documents last week that spelled out a number of things that they've learned from Cohen, although unfortunately for us on the outside trying to understand the story, a lot of those things weren't in the court papers. But they also didn't take a position on whether or not he should get the prescribed prison sentence that the other party in the case, the Southern District of New York, was asking for in its brief for the judge. Cohen had kind of two separate problems with the feds. He had one in New York City, which was being handled by SDNY, as we call it, and then we had the separate special counsel matter, which is based in Washington. Ultimately, this case was resolved today by the sentencing in federal court in New York City, but there's some suggestion by Cohen's lawyer and potentially Cohen himself that he could continue working with the special counsel's office. That's not clear, except to say that they want to make a clean breast of this if they can. They want to own up to what he's done and try and move forward.
The president first denied knowledge of the payments to the women. Now he and his supporters are saying this isn't important. What does Cohen's sentence mean to President Trump?
That's another great question. A lot of that depends on the actions taken by the Justice Department going forward. The plea that Cohen has reached implicates the president in what federal prosecutors say is a federal crime. This campaign contribution, they say, was in effect what was happening when Cohen made these payments. The president and his attorneys have taken the position that that wasn't against the law, and if Cohen did something wrong, that's on him, not on the president, because Cohen was an attorney acting on the president's behalf. We don't know the answer to that question, and we don't know what will come of it, because that could depend on the action of the Justice Department and the special counsel's office.
We also don't know what might have happened had Americans been able to know what these women were claiming and that they were being paid off in the run-up to an election. We don't know. NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Trump administration advisor Wells Griffith was heckled by activists this week when he advocated for coal and natural gas at the UN Climate Change Summit in Poland.
And fossil fuels will continue to play a leading role.
World leaders at that summit are debating whether to embrace the findings of the International Panel on Climate Change's devastating report from October. The IPCC report predicts that the impact of climate change could be drastic and irreversible as early as 2040. But the U.S. is joining oil-producing countries, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Russia, in saying that negotiators should simply take note of those findings and not welcome or endorse them. Well, meanwhile, another dire warning on the impacts of climate change was released last night. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's 2018 Arctic Report Card says that the Arctic has experienced the most unprecedented transition in history in terms of warming temperature and melting ice, and that those changes are having cascading effects on climate and weather around the globe. Lead editor on that report is Emily Osborne. She joins us from the American Geophysical Union's annual conference in D.C., where the Arctic Report Card was unveiled yesterday. Dr. Osborne, thank you. And I don't want to be flip, but it sounds like a giant F on the world's response to these concerns.
So we don't actually give the Arctic a grade, despite its name, the Arctic Report Card. But yeah, we're continuing to see a lot of these long-term changes in the Arctic. So each year we report on things like surface air temperature. So we had the second warmest air temperature across 2018 in the Arctic. As you said, our record started in the year 1900. Very warm seas in the Arctic, particularly the northern Bering Sea, was a really interesting place where a story unfolded in 2018 for us.
The northern Bering Sea, others are calling this the big story in ice this year. Why? What happened there?
So what we saw was that leading up to the winter time, we had these very, very warm sea surface temperatures, which preconditioned the ocean to not allow for sea ice to form in the Bering Sea the way that it has in years past. And so throughout the entire ice period over the winter, we saw the lowest ice extent ever recorded for the Bering Sea. And that's had pretty big implications for the entire marine ecosystem there.
We're hearing that the Bering Sea lost an area of ice the size of Idaho.
That is correct.
So what? First of all, back us up, because we've been hearing for years now, we've been seeing the pictures of polar bears stranded on ice floes surrounded by water. We know the Arctic is losing ice. Remind us, first of all, why it means so much to the global environment when instead of snow-covered white ice, we have water.
So we were talking earlier about why the Arctic warming at twice the rate the rest of the globe is. And so one of the big reasons of why the Arctic is warming like that is because we're seeing these white reflective surfaces not there anymore.
Not reflecting.
They're not reflecting that sunlight back and that energy back into the atmosphere. And instead, it's absorbing it. And that's just causing this runaway effect and for, you know, more ice, more snow to continue melting as we have this more heat being able to absorb into these dark surfaces.
And those dark surfaces, the waters are heating up because of that. And what does it mean that instead of having ice that just builds on itself, old ice, we have no ice or new ice? Why is old ice so important?
Old ice is so important because it's really resistant to melting. And so when observations started back in the 70s, we had about 16% of the ice cover in the Arctic was very old or more than 4 years old. And this year we're seeing that in the Arctic, less than 1% of the Arctic ice pack is very old multi-year ice. And that just means that ice, that single year, that first year ice is much more prone to melting. And so we're seeing just more and more melt happening as a result of that change.
And that 1% of the Arctic ice that's ice pack this year is a decline of 95% over the last 33 years. So you're seeing these accelerating problems. And what else are the issues? Okay, we hear about the warming seas. That's a big deal in and of itself. But those are producing the toxic algae that we see in places like Florida, but it's up there in the Arctic?
Correct. So this is something that we featured this year in the Arctic Report Card. It's emerging as this new, really big issue that we've been focusing specifically in the Bering Strait this year. It's a really big concern to the communities that live off of the ocean, that go out, that harvest clams, that eat walrus. And these animals are consuming these harmful algal blooms and concentrating these toxins in the tissue that these communities are harvesting and eating. And because we don't have commercial fisheries in the Arctic, that walrus and these clams that are being harvested by subsistence hunters are not considered commercial. There's no mandated regulation for the U.S. to provide any sort of testing or monitoring for these harmful algal blooms in this area. And so essentially what Alaska has to say is just don't eat this food. And the ocean is really the grocery store for the people that live on the coast in Alaska. They can't just go to Harris Teeter and buy things to make a salad. That's just not really an option for them.
Right. Well, so it has this very local effect, but of course nothing's local when it comes to the ocean and it comes to the food chain. You know, eventually things spread. And that includes weather. Now, explain to us, we had this huge spike in cold temperatures here in New England. In Europe, they had that, what they call the beast from the east, that cold spell. And we understand that it has to do with, you know, everything you're describing is making the jet streams wobbly, so they're not allowed to act as the lasso that they can be to lasso the cold air and keep it up in the Arctic North. Explain what's happening.
That is correct. So the way that the jet stream works is that it moves in a very straight path very quickly when the Arctic is very cold and the lower latitudes are warmer. So we have this temperature difference that allows for that path of the jet stream to move very quickly and in a very straight fashion. And so as the Arctic is warming at this really rapid rate, the jet stream is in fact slowing down. And as it slows, it creates these wobbles, as you had mentioned. And so when we have this wavy jet stream pattern, we have these really different air masses reaching different parts of the globe. And so if we have a wiggle that brings in warm air from where we live up into the Arctic, we're going to see heat waves happening in March, as we did in 2018, where we have 20 degrees Celsius temperatures warmer than usual. And then at the same time, that wobble is going to bring those cold temperatures, that Arctic air surge, down into the lower 48. Yeah.
Look, the report uses phrases like uncharted territory, rapid unraveling of the Arctic region. Is it too late?
I wouldn't say that it's too late. I am not ready to give up hope. There are changes that I believe that we can make to stomp the direction that we are moving in.
With emissions?
I think emissions is, in my personal opinion, one of the biggest things that we really need to work on curbing. But again, I think that is something that's going to take years for us to get on the right path. But at the same time, in the meantime, with this information, I think that we're armed with the best knowledge to try to build resilient communities, build adaptive communities, so that these people that live on the coast, that are in the Arctic, that are really being faced with this change, kind of like the ground zero of climate change, that they are armed with as much information as possible to try to protect their communities, to protect their livelihood, and to really just continue in the best way that they can.
Well, just real quick, you said it's going to take years. The UN devastating report said we have till 2040 before we see some irreversible damage. How many years do you think we have when it comes to the Arctic?
I think that's really hard to say. I don't know if anyone could really put a number on it. The system, as I've said, is just changing very rapidly. Particularly the Bering Sea is one of the places that is just changing in such an incredibly rapid way that scientists who have been working in the Bering Sea for their entire careers, 30, 40 years, just weren't anticipating seeing in their career, in their lifetime. And so I don't want to send a message of give up hope. I think there should be optimism that we should continue to try to kind of turn things around and go back.
That's Dr. Emily Osborne, lead editor on the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's NOAA's 2018 Arctic Report Card. Dr. Osborne, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And we'd love to hear your thoughts. Have you become sort of numb to these reports? Does each sound like the last one, or is this one maybe standing out for you? Let us know. HereAndNow.org.
The National Institutes of Health announced this week that it will soon fund research to find alternatives to the use of human fetal tissue in the fight against diseases like HIV. The news comes after reports that the Trump administration has shut down at least one NIH study that uses fetal tissue implanted into mice. Opponents of abortion rights have long tried to end government funding for fetal tissue research, an issue that became a flashpoint in 2015 when a heavily edited video falsely claimed that Planned Parenthood was selling tissue from aborted fetuses to researchers. Joining us now is Ike Sweatlitz, correspondent with our partners at Stat News, the health and medicine publication. He's in Washington. Ike, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And let's get to the beginning of this story, first of all, which is the Trump administration shutting down this NIH study looking into a potential cure for HIV. What happened?
Yeah, so the Trump administration has been involved in sort of a wide-ranging audit of the federal research that involves fetal tissue. In the midst of that audit, the National Institutes of Health put a pause on the ordering of any new fetal tissue, unless the researchers got a certain exception. And at least in one of those cases, it's been reported from conversations with colleagues who work with those labs that's in effect stopped some of the research that's going on there.
And so now the NIH is going to try to find alternatives that it can fund instead of using fetal tissue?
So around the same time this news came out, the NIH announced that they intend to spend about $20 million over the next 2 years looking at alternatives, yes.
And are there alternatives out there?
So one of the things that human fetal tissue is used for is to build systems to test drugs. So when we're talking about alternatives, what we're really talking about are other systems to test drugs. So, for example, you know, we've heard a lot about organoids, which are little collections of cells that sort of act like organs, like a little bit of a brain or a little bit of a stomach. So you could maybe build those in a petri dish to test a drug without having to test the drug in an animal that's modified with human fetal tissue. That's what, you know, some of this is used for, to create animals that are a little more human-like because they've been modified with human fetal tissue and therefore, you know, serve as a good testing platform for the drugs.
And there's not a law out there that's against using fetal tissue in research. It's just that the administration, whatever administration happens to be in the White House, can control what funding goes to what. Is that right?
So some states do have laws that regulate or restrict or prevent the sale or transfer of human fetal tissue. There's actually a case challenging one of those laws in Indiana right now. Mm-hmm. So there are some restrictions that exist at the state level, but from a federal level, an independent researcher, you know, can work with this material as long as they're following the other regulations.
But obviously, government funding is very important to scientists. Could the researchers get fetal tissue to do this research without federal funding?
So right now, the pause on buying new fetal tissue only is directly impacting researchers who are employed by the NIH. So there are other researchers who are getting government funding, who are getting NIH funding, who are still able to procure this material, outside people working for a university or something else like that. So right now, there's not a direct impact on them. There's an indirect impact, though, in that they will now have a harder time collaborating with the folks that do work at the NIH. And because the mice that are created with this tissue are expensive and time-consuming and resource-intensive to maintain, there are not a ton of people out there who are doing this. So it's sort of having ripple effects throughout the field.
Well, and what's the effect on research into HIV and other diseases?
Yes, so I think maybe we should step back a little bit to talk about what this tissue is used for. So researchers take a little bit of fetal tissue cell samples and they put them into a mouse, and it creates a human-like immune system in the mouse. Mm-hmm. And then they can use that to test drugs or treatments or study how the immune system works. And since HIV is a disease of the immune system, that's been a good way to study that. So if researchers are not able to use these sorts of mice anymore, not able to create these sorts of mice anymore, it would impact those sorts of studies. There are alternatives out there. You know, they have advantages and disadvantages depending on the research project that you're conducting.
What has been the reaction to all of this news? Like, the people that you're talking to, what are they saying, how they feel about this?
So the scientists who have been involved in this sort of research or doing this research are not pleased. They also point out that, as I said before, these mice are difficult and expensive to work with, so they're really only using them when they need to. Something else I think that's important to note is that this is not the first time that these kinds of research techniques have come under scrutiny from the federal government. So people who have been in this field for a while are used to these sorts of political conversations mm-hmm. about their work.
That is Ike Swetlitz, who is Washington correspondent with our partners at Stat News, the health and medicine publication. Ike, thank you.
Thank you.
And your thoughts on this story, welcome at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.